Thank you very much, Mike, for that kind introduction. And I would like to dedicate today's talk to the person who I think was my most important teacher, the most important influence in my career, and that is Howard Card. He was a professor of electrical engineering at the University of Manitoba, and I had him in my senior year for two courses in semiconductor physics. And he was an absolutely remarkable man who really turned me on to physics. He would always talk about the Feynman lectures in physics and how every 4 years he would read them from cover to cover. And he died, unfortunately, this past fall at the age of 59 from lymphoma. And so I'd like to dedicate this talk to him. All right. What's going on? Oh, there we go. Okay, so as Mike said, I've been teaching introductory physics for everyone but the physics majors and engineers at Cornell. So that includes lots of people, who I'll mention in a moment, but particularly life science and pre-medical students. And this course, it's a calculus-based course on mechanics and heat. It's the first course of a two-semester sequence. And the format of the course is we have 3 one-hour lectures each week. I give each lecture twice so that we can accommodate all the students who want to take it. We have 2 one-hour recitations each week and 1 2-hour lab each week. And the enrollment is actually currently limited by the available lab space at 300. The syllabus is a standard course in mechanics and heat. It's the only major differences from what most of you probably took is that we spend a lot of time talking about fluids, static and moving fluids. But beyond that, it's a pretty standard course in terms of the syllabus. The majors of the students who take this course, biological and life sciences, chemistry, geology, human ecology, meteorology, English, government, economics, so basically all sorts of people except for the engineers and the physicists. And it's about 50 to 60% of the students are pre-medical or pre-vet. This shows their academic year. At Cornell, unlike here, they are afraid, well, probably like here, they're afraid of physics. And so they wait to take it, not in their freshman year, but in their sophomore or junior year, so that they have it closer to when they take the MCAT, and so the results will be familiar. So this shows a poll of the students. What do you plan to do after graduating? So you can see about 60% want to go to med school, 30% want to go to grad school, 18% get a job, and you can see the rest. Okay. So what was your primary reason for signing up for the course? So you can imagine that with these kinds of numbers, this is an actual question. I poll them. So one of the things, message I hope to get across is that now with systems like Blackboard or even using SurveyMonkey, it's very, very easy to poll your students and find out exactly very detailed information about them and what they think about your course and to use that information to tune your message. So this is exactly the question I asked, and that was their response. And that's pretty discouraging, right? Pretty discouraging. And so then this is another question. And these are their honest answers. And again, you know, it seems like the odds are against us here. And I'm sure if you asked a student taking an introductory history course that they wouldn't respond in quite this way. So this is actually a problem for those of us who teach it because of these, the fact that they're taking the course as a requirement and they're very anxious about it. When it comes to evaluate the course, those facts tend to show up in their evaluation. So this shows over a 9-year period, the average course, the overall course evaluation by the students, the score out of 5, for this pre-medical course, for our engineering sequence, and for our physics major sequence. And you can see that those of us who teach the pre-med course get consistently much worse evaluations than those who are teaching the engineers or especially the majors. And this is despite the fact that Cornell, my department, has historically put its most talented lecturers and put its greatest efforts into teaching innovation into this sequence. In fact, when I was an assistant professor, From the years 1992 to 1994, I was involved in a major revamp of this course, which introduced many state-of-the-art, which are still state-of-the-art, pedagogical methods and fabulous labs and many great innovations led by Raphael Littauer, who is the single most brilliant educator I have ever encountered. He introduced electronic polling. He designed and built an electronic polling system for one of our big lecture rooms in 1971 and has been using polling in his classes, and it's been used at Cornell since 1971. So Missouri gets a lot of credit. Littauer did everything he did except for the peer instruction part 20 years before. So can you guess? You know, there's no guess, though, despite the fact that he was the lecturer, and the lectures were spectacular. I mean, this was unlike, you know, I'd been through all my undergrad education, my grad education, and then through several other faculty at Cornell, rookied with them. This was by far the most spectacular course I'd ever seen, but nowhere is this reflected in how the students perceive the course. And if you look at the written comments, nowhere is this reflected. Some students loved him, some students hated him. That's true of any professor who's ever taught the course. So this is profoundly discouraging to those of us who are serious about teaching and put a lot of effort into it. There's just no reward or no apparent reward for these large efforts. So I asked a friend of mine, he's a mechanical engineer, and he's a graduate of Cornell. I asked him, what adjectives would you use to describe Cornell pre-meds? And these are the adjectives he came up with. So then I thought to myself, well, you know, what adjectives would you use to describe Cornell physics faculty? And actually, except for brilliant. So the point here is that these students are people we should be able to understand, right? We should be able to understand these students, right? We should be able to connect with them. There's another reason why it's really important that we connect with them. First of all, this course has over 50% women, unlike our physics major course, which has about 10% women, and our engineering sequence, which has about 20% women. It has 15% underrepresented minority, and there are essentially no underrepresented minorities in any of our other physics courses. And it also has by far the greatest socioeconomic diversity among the students. So how can we, you know, if we're interested in, for example, having more women, more people from lower socioeconomic classes, you know, increasing diversity in physics, the standard approach that physics departments use is when a person in a target group becomes available for a faculty position, is on the job market and they're hiring, they try to hire that person. But, you know, if we're not connecting with these students, we're essentially shooting all of those people at the door, right, before they ever can get through the system and become professors. So there's really no hope of significantly increasing diversity unless we address the huge attrition that occurs among these groups as one goes from high school through to the end of undergraduate. So what are the guiding principles? So the first thing is these students are smart, they're curious, and they're motivated, right? Even if they may hate us, we have to grudgingly admit these facts. The other thing is that, you know, we physicists, we either sort of arrogant, you know, oh, people who don't appreciate physics are too stupid, or else we're insecure. Well, you know, maybe what we're doing really isn't as important as what the biologists are doing. Well, both of those are nonsense, right? Physics is fascinating and it's incredibly empowering, right? We should be, my belief is that the enrollment in physics courses, our goal should be to consume all the undergraduates at our universities so that they're all taking physics at some point. We should have expansionist vision, right? Maybe I've been in the States too long, but that's my, right? Because we've got a great product to offer. And so if the students don't learn the material, we've got these great students, we've got this great subject, right? If they don't learn the material and don't like our course, it's our fault. Okay? That's the starting point. It's our fault. We can't blame anyone else for this. So, some guiding principles. Students in physics courses only master a small fraction of the material with which they're presented. Physics is by far the most concept-dense course of anything in the undergraduate curriculum. In my transition to be trying to do some things in biology, I took undergraduate biochemistry at Cornell, I took undergraduate cell biology, and I took graduate protein chemistry. And these courses are absolutely trivial compared to an intro physics course. I mean, I could show up and listen and understand things. As an assistant professor, showing up and listening to an intro physics course lecture, I still couldn't understand half the material, right? And so the point is that, you know, let's focus on the fundamental concepts and keep the math simple. Eliminate the distractors. Leave out tricky details, right? Second thing is that physics provides the foundation for analyzing data and solving problems across the sciences and across all disciplines, actually, economics, right? The kinds of tools that we use, physicists are famous for developing tools and exporting them to other disciplines, right? And I think, aside from the importance of knowing physics, it's really important that we convey to our students that they're going to learn practical skills that will be useful no matter what they do. And so you want to emphasize these transferable skills in what you teach. And this was actually a part of this innovation that was led by this brilliant faculty member in the early to mid-90s. And this is things like plotting data, sketching functions, dimensional analysis, proportional reasoning, order of magnitude estimates and approximate models, estimation, exponentials, and power laws. These are all basic, you know, skills that every scientist, engineer, economist should have at their fingertips. Another guiding principle is that my surveys have found that, and also just the experience of anyone who teaches these students, I mean, it's especially apparent at Cornell because many of the students are coming to me as juniors, and they know no math. It's really astonishing how poor their math skills are. And if you look at the biology and chemistry courses they take, they see incredibly little math in those courses. It's really astonishing how little math is taught in those courses, how little math is used. And the math that trips them up in physics is not calculus, which they typically take at the university level. It's really high school level math. That is the math that, unless you're a theoretical physicist, it's the kind of math that we use all the time that I tend to call elementary scientific mathematics. So this is, again, maybe I'll... wish I could. Maybe I'll move this down here or something. So this is again from beginning of semester polls of the students, online polls. You know, how much of each of these math skills have you used and seen in your other courses, other science courses, not math at Cornell? So trigonometry, 33% say they've seen none. And if you look at the exams, it's true, right? They just don't see it. You know, also geometry. I'm always astonished. You know, you ask them to calculate the volume of a sphere, or the surface area of a sphere. Or this, particularly important in biological systems, surface to volume ratios, right? They don't have a clue what you're talking about, right? So actually, this is a cartoon I like for geometry. So what does Long John say? Arr, right? So I also like this cartoon. This is from the New Yorker. And I immediately clipped out this cartoon when I saw it. And about a year later, they had this two-page article. And it was on cartoons that had gotten the most responses from readers, the most number of bewildered responses. What the hell was that cartoon about? Right? And this was the number one cartoon. So, you know, if you're worried about American economic dominance, just be patient, right? Okay. So proportional reasoning. So you can go through all these things. Sinusoidal functions of time, right? This is the bread and butter of a lot of physics, right? They don't see any of that. They've never seen, they don't know what omega is, right, when they come into my class. You know, back of the envelope calculations. You know, what I find astonishing, you know, log-log plots and semi-log plots are everywhere in science, especially in biology. In biology, they call it allometry, right? Looking for scaling relations, which then give you some clue to physics and to the underlying biology and science. You know, 51% of them have never seen a log-log plot, right? This is astonishing and terrible, right? And so when I don't care about teaching them calculus. These are the kinds of skills that I think are important for them to know, and these are the ones we'll emphasize in the course. Okay. So one of the things we did in response to this is I've developed, it's still very crude, but an online tutorial and evaluation system in this elementary scientific mathematics. It basically, I went through every kind of math they would see in the course, and we made up problems on every single one of those things with the physics formulas stripped out. That's sort of the first incarnation. And they can take these pretests before they do the homework or when they start the class or whenever they want to get warmed up in the basic math skills. Okay. Comments that one sees. These are actual comments from, written comments from course evaluations in Physics 207. Right. So, I hate physics, and physics makes me feel dumb. And one of my trivial but most important insights was that these two facts are intimately related, right? Most students actually don't hate physics. They hate how physics makes them feel about themselves. It makes them feel stupid. And we all know that, right? When we come up against a physics problem, we gotta bang our heads at it for hours, right? And then finally, you know, something vaguely clicks into place and then it gradually solidifies over some long period of time. This is totally different, you know, if you took Intro Psych. I mean, Intro Psych was my favorite class as an undergraduate. I showed up, the stuff was fascinating, and I understood it immediately, right? That doesn't happen with physics. It makes us feel dumb, right? And unless you're really secure, or unless you're trained to accept the fact that that's okay, right, then you're going to have a bad reaction. And there's this quote, let me read this to you, which I think sums up part of the issue. There are, of course, other ways in which schools represent a psychic fall, and teachers the guardian angels of its trajectory. Although schools in a democracy purport to exist for the creation of a level playing field, it does not take us long to discover that level playing fields exist mainly to sort out winners from losers. Unless we came from a large family with parents who went out of their way to play favorites, school is our first introduction to the idea of relative merit. But that oppressive sense of minute gradation, of success not as a mansion of many rooms, which is in fact what it is, the world is an ecosystem and we all find our place in it, but as a ladder of infinite rungs, where does that exist but in a classroom or in the imagination of the adult who still sits there? And I would say physics classroom in particular, right? Taking your degree is the most precise phrase in all of education. That is what we take from our first day of kindergarten, our degree of relative worth. The educational apple of Adam's fall did not give us knowledge of good and evil, but of good, better, and best, world without end. And this is from an article titled Why We Hate Our Teachers. And I think it's why we hate our physics teachers, right? So I think a key part of what I've tried to do in my teaching to this clientele at Cornell is to provide consistent and continual emotional support and encouragement to all students, and in particular to struggling students. And the key phrase is here, you're not dumb, right? This stuff is just challenging. You need to be patient. Give yourself time with the material. You know, if it takes you half an hour and you don't have the answer, that's normal, right? Think about bedside manner. I use the example, I had some root planing, and you know, where they go in and scrape the plaques off your roots and then basically come with a router and route away the gum tissue beside the roots, right? And my periodontist, you know, he explains to me very carefully, you know, well, here's what's going to happen. You may feel some discomfort here, you know, and let's do some relaxation exercises. You know, there's a whole bedside manner. And it made an enormous difference to that experience. We should do the same things with our students in physics classes. Make them understand that the discomfort they're feeling is natural. Give them roots. give them an understanding that physics is not something that is innate. Physics talent is not something that's innate. It's something that can be mastered. And that through consistent effort. And this is a particularly important message to send out to female students. There's a wonderful book out of studies on why aren't there as many women in science. It just came out. It's edited by two faculty at Cornell. And one of the essays talks about how women students are much more likely to view talent, science, or ability in science as a gift rather than something that you work hard at to achieve mastery at. And we all know none of us are that gifted, right? We got good at physics because we worked our tails off at it, right? And it's just like any other subject. It just takes work. And that's the message we need to send. Okay, so I send out regular emails to the students, you know, like before the exams, I'll send them, you know, studying tips. If I get feedback the students are discouraged or struggling with something, you know, I give them words of encouragement, right? The other thing I do, which at first I was a little nervous about, but it's turned out to work out rather well, I tell the students, if you have a question about physics, you know, about a homework problem and that, stay away. I do not want to talk to you, right? You can talk to me before and after lecture, but I don't have regular office hours. That's not my job. I have a whole army of TAs who are perfectly, and we have open office hours. They can handle those kinds of questions. I want to spend my time dealing with the strategic issues in your approach to the material. How are you studying for the material? How are you approaching the homework? How are you approaching exams? How are you preparing? You know, I want to deal with these fundamentally psychological educational issues rather than content issues. And that's what I spend. All my interactions with students are in that area. And they like it, to my surprise. The other thing is, you want to have a very even flow in the course. There's no need to trick these students, right? There's no need to trick them. You just want to get a grade distribution so you can bend them. That's fundamentally what you want. You want a grade distribution so you can sort them out by ability. And especially if you've got median grades on your transcript, the consumers of the grades, employers and so on, will know what an A means and what a B means, right? And so so we use a very pragmatic, non-inflammatory grading system. The exam questions are just straightforward variations of homework and lab questions. And the best students get 100. And we use absolute grading. And the median on the exams is typically around 70, okay, 70 to 75. And we always, in physics, we have this notion that we need to be the gatekeepers. That we've had this is our role for the university. But who the hell said we need to take on that role? Why do we have to be, you know, the border agents, you know, who frisk you and insult you? And why is that our job, right? Our job should be promoting our abilities and interest in our discipline, and to hell with that role. Right? And so why don't set the median lower than other intro courses? And in particular, why rub their noses in the fact that they can't master all of the stuff we try to shove down their throats in one semester? Right? If anything, we should have higher means to support them. Okay? Another guiding principle is that, you know, I came from, you know, Manitoba, where, you know, it was engineering, you know, the person on the right, first day, you know, the dean comes and says, you know, look, the person on your right, the person on your left, you know, only one of you will be here in 4 years, right? And, you know, they kept on giving grades of, I remember, a fourth-year class where a third of the class got Fs, right? My feeling is, and it's partly coming from a high-priced private institution, I mean, where the students are paying a fortune to be there, is that every grade or D or F that we hand out represents a failure on our part, right? These students are paying bucks to be here. We need to give them feedback. If they're getting into trouble, we need to tell them they're getting into trouble. We need to offer them the support they need. If they don't respond to that support, we need to get them out of the course because they're just wasting resources. They need to go and take some other supplementary courses, develop whatever maturity or skills they need to succeed. If they're not going to succeed, you know, if they aren't willing to make the effort to succeed, get them out of the course. And at the same time, we have to provide them with what they need to succeed. And so one of the nice side benefits of this, the competing course to mine, which is an auto-tutorial algebra-based course, you know, we'll give out 20 or 30 Fs in a term. We give out none. That allows us, by getting all those students out, allows our median grade, you know, it's not so bad that our median grade is not a C+. Another thing is that, and this is very common physics education research is get the students involved. So use polling in the classroom, right, which you folks are using here. It's really, once you've used polling, you'll never go back. It's just such a fabulous way of teaching. You get instant feedback on what the students are thinking, and you can respond to what they're thinking. Involve them in the lecture demonstrations. Actually get them up helping you with a demo, right? Don't just make it like you're, you know, Dr. Science or something. Then I mentioned the idea of using regular online surveys to figure out, you know, what they're thinking about the course. So this is another set of comments from the course. You know, why am I forced to take this course? And what use is this stuff to my major? And there's actually the core of this question. If you look psychologically, you know, when we're children, the whole world is about us, right? Our world is us, and the world around us is essentially extensions of us. And as we mature through our teens, hopefully as we mature, right, that we gradually recognize the outside world as being distinct from ourselves and having value outside of ourselves, right? And fundamentally, what the root of this question is what does this, why, what does this have to do with me, right? 18-year-olds care about them, themselves. What does this have to do with me? And we can, you know, kvetch about that, you know, whatever. You know, I mentioned that just before I came here, I was riding in an elevator in my building from the fifth floor to the first floor, and one of our undergraduates got on at the fifth floor, and he says to me, gee, I'm not really sure what floor I want to go to, so I'll press these buttons, right? Okay, so, you know, not quite connected into, you know, but this is the reality. This is what we're dealing with, and so we got to roll with what we're given with, okay? So the other thing is that many students are driven by a desire not to do something useful or lucrative. I mean, are driven to do something useful or lucrative, not by truth and beauty. I know for physicists this is a very abstract concept, but we have to accept the fact that not everyone is like us, right? And many students have little idea how or why physics may be relevant to their future careers. And what's amazing is you can poll students after they've taken physics, college physics courses, and they still have no idea what good this is to their careers. And so it's incredibly important to illustrate why physics matters to them, what it has to do with them. And I think it's relating it to their everyday experience, and not just to stuff from many, many disciplines. And what we want to emphasize is the interconnectedness of science, to show how phenomena and theory in distinct areas are interleaved into a complex and self-consistent tapestry. And this is the role of physics. The chemist can't do it. The biologists certainly can't do it, right? The mathematicians can't do it. We're the only ones who can give them a sense of the big picture. And we should do that. That is our responsibility. And in particular, we should avoid physics for biologists or physics for engineers, right? There are, of course, many places where the engineers or the biologists have taken over physics, and it may well be true that the students are less likely to shoot the messenger. There's no evidence that they get the message any better, right? So that's all bullshit, and you should fight against those people. On the other hand, we also shouldn't be teaching physics for physicists, right? We want to teach physics for people, right? And this is, you know, Steven Weinberg's one of my personal heroes, and this is something he said. Weinberg provides, or this is from a book review of a review of a book he wrote, and it's Weinberg provides one of the clearest arguments I have ever read against the relevance of astrology, telekinesis, creationism, and other would-be sciences, as he politely refers to them. Why do scientists feel completely free to ignore such subjects without even extending to them the courtesy of an examination? Weinberg argues, what these people are missing is the sense of the connectedness of scientific knowledge. We do not understand everything, but we understand enough to know that there is no room in our world for telekinesis or astrology. What possible physical signal from our brains could move distant objects and yet have no effect on any scientific instruments? In fact, I don't think that most people who believe in astrology imagine that it works the way it does because of gravitation or any other agency within the scope of physics. I think they believe that astrology is an autonomous science with its own fundamental laws, not to be explained in terms of physics or anything else. One of the great services provided by the discovery of the pattern of scientific explanation is to show us that there are no such autonomous sciences, except for maybe string theory, right? Right? So the point is that there's just, as our understanding gets, we get this interconnected web, there's just no room, right? And, you know, when there's a debate about evolution, right? Eventually, our understanding of evolution from the historical and molecular level will become so intertwined with our understanding of quantum mechanics and chemistry and all of these fields that for it to be fundamentally wrong would require an overturning of our entire worldview, which would become at some point impossible. And so this is what we want to try. This, when I say about trying to convey the big picture, this is what we as physicists are in the best place to do. Okay, so what do I actually do? So there's this math tutorial. When the students walk into the lecture room, I have a PowerPoint show that's auto-running. And it's actually, when I was up here visiting my brother, we went to one of the movie theaters in Burlington. And, you know, they have these slideshows which ask you trivia and stuff, you know, and then before they start the film clips. And I thought, well, let's do the same thing in the physics class. So they have announcements, you know, all the announcements. I don't make any announcements or any discussion of anything other than physics in the actual course. All that's shoveled off to the pre- and post-lecture period. Then I use transparency notes. So I write on transparencies. I have two overhead projectors. I write on one, transfer, write on one, transfer. I have lots of demonstrations, with 2 to 3 per lecture. I have in-class polling, which is on the transparencies, so I poll them. And then I have over 100 PowerPoint slideshows that I typically spend 10 to 15 minutes per lecture talking about applications of the physics. And there's some other stuff, but I won't go into it. So this is a picture of the actual lecture room. It's one of the oldest rooms, it hasn't been updated in 50 years. But you can see the configuration. I've got two overheads. So, for example, I could have a polling question here. I could have the physics that they're being polled on shown here. And I can have some application over here that I'm showing simultaneously. And I think this is really, if you're designing new classrooms, this is really an ideal configuration for instruction. You can have many things going on. I've taught in rooms where, you know, the standard modern lecture room, there's this big screen at the front where you can project PowerPoint. But if you want to switch between PowerPoint and handwritten things or PowerPoint and something else, you can't do it. It's just awful. So I really like this configuration. This is the polling system. It's hardwired. This is it's an analog readout. 1971, continuous use, right? 20 years before Missouri ever woke up to this idea. So let me show you these are examples of slides from a pre-lecture PowerPoint show. So, you know, this is if they miss work, these are the things they should do. Sorry, this thing's slightly annoying. You know, homework's due. Right? I don't know. I have this one outside my office because this is those of us who have to write proposals and all about the Grim Reaper. This is one I showed. This was just before when Angela Merkel was just the run-up to the German elections before she won. This was an article. It was actually a quote from Science magazine, but it was pointing out that she held a PhD in physical chemistry. And the influential newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung wrote that Merkel had demonstrated both meticulous and tenacity in her 1986 dissertation on the calculation of rate constants in hydrocarbon decomposition reactions. Such qualities, the paper said, could be usefully applied to the equally complex problems facing Germany. So then I said, well, could you imagine, for example, USA Today saying something similar about a U.S. presidential candidate? Al Gore. Well, unfortunately, we know what happened to him. He was elected president. No, we won't go there. Okay. So then another time they walk in, and I'm playing these etudes by Chopin. and over the sound system, right? And it's spectacular. If those of you who know music, I'm sure you're familiar with them, but they have to play almost 4,000 notes in 2.5 minutes in this thing. And so this is when we're talking about just speed, you know, in kinematics. And so you can compare the time between each note with the time it takes a neural impulse to propagate from the brain to the finger. And, oops, it's blocked again. Oh. But what you can quickly convince yourself of is that they aren't sight reading. Right? They practice this. Okay. So then I won't go through this, but this is a quote about Newton when he was a professor, right? And I don't know. Hopefully things aren't like that here today. But here's one. So when we talk about thermal expansion, right? I talk about thermal properties of matter. And so this is Teganic Falls. It's about 7 miles north of Ithaca. You should all come and visit sometime. I'll take you on a tour. And it's the highest waterfall in the northeast. It's higher than Niagara Falls. It's a 210-foot straight vertical drop. And it has this spectacular amphitheater with walls that rise to over 400 feet. And so the question is, what role does thermal expansion play in forming a Teganic amphitheater? Right? And so this is a cue in to something. Then I talk about thermal expansion. And this is something that they all know about, they're all familiar with. And then I can explain, you know, how thermal expansion of... So it's basically the spray from the waterfall. The fine spray freezes on the walls, seeps into cracks in this very sedimentary rock, expands, contracts, shatters the rock, and then you get the crumpling. And that's the erosion mechanism. Okay? So then I go on to... transparency notes. I spend about 10 minutes introducing the new material, and then I immediately go to multiple choice questions to lead them through the key ideas. And I interleave this with demonstrations and with PowerPoint applications. So let me give you a flavor for how this works in the rest of my time today. So, which of the following four velocity time graphs best describes the motion of a foot relative to the ground during ordinary walking? Okay? So you have, those of you who have clickers can register your votes. So which of those velocity time graphs? And this is a nice problem because, of course, they walk all the time. It's a motion that they're very familiar with, even though they may not have thought about it in detail. Okay? So we have 50. How many clickers do we have out there? All right.
63.
All right. So, okay. Okay. So, all right. So we have, it's a smart group. Okay. So what actually happens, right? When you're walking, basically one foot is planted. That just happened? You're messing with me. This actually reminds me of sometimes I can't control myself and say things I shouldn't say in lecture, and I apologize to the students afterwards, but I walking to lecture, I went in the restroom, and I was washing my hands, and a student came in, spat in the sink, and walked out. So I went into the lecture room, and at the start of the lecture I said, okay, I'd like to know, how many of you think it's okay to spit in a public sink or in a public drinking fountain? Okay? And so we'll use the polling system. And, oh, by the way, I only want the women to vote. Right? And so then it comes up, 20% of them thought it was okay. And it was clear, I heard the murmuring, it was clear the guys were going to, they voted the 20%. So about halfway through the lecture, I just couldn't believe this, right? So I said, well, okay, so, how many of you think that if you've got a cold, and, you're dripping, how many of you think it's okay to, take one of the plates in the dining hall and drip on the plate and then put it back on the stack, And then I polled them, and 20% thought it was okay. And I said, so, right? So then I said to them, well, at least you're consistent, Okay. So, but anyways, your foot's planted for half the cycle, and during the other half, it's moving, like a pendulum. Okay. So here's a a simple problem in projectile motion. You throw an object over horizontal ground, and the question is, it lands at the same height from which you throw it. How does the time that it spends going up compare with the time that it spends coming down? Now, I won't poll you on this. What's the answer? It's got to be the same. Okay, it spends the same amount of time going up as it does coming down in the absence of air resistance. Okay, here's another question. It rises to some height y max. How does the amount of time it spends in the top half of its flight compare with the time it spends in the bottom half of its flight? And here I'll test you on that. Okay, I just want to move on here. So more time in the upper part, good, right? That's the right answer. And, you know, the simple reason is that your speed, yes, I'm on to you. The simple answer is that as you approach the apex of your flight, you slow down. Your Y motion gets smaller and smaller. And it goes to zero at the top, and it changes sign. So near the top of your flight, you're moving very slowly compared to near the bottom where you're moving close to your maximum speed. So you spend a lot more time on the top of your flight. Well, what does that have to do with anything? Well, think about basketball players, right? So when I... Now watch me carefully. Right? Did you notice? How long? I just seem to be hanging in midair there. All right? Well, this is why. Okay? That's the basic physics. Okay, here's another favorite problem, right? You've got three masses hung from three ropes like this. And the question is, what's the ratio of the tension in the top rope to the bottom rope? And you can work this out, right? It's the tension, the top rope is supporting the weight of the three masses. The bottom rope is supporting the weight of only the bottom mass. So the ratio of the tension is 3:1. Okay? And, well, what about if you consider a problem where instead of hanging, they're now on a frictionless incline? It'll be the same answer, right? What does that have to do with anything? Well, it turns out, if you look at coal trains, they want to ship coal economically, and you want to make the trains as long as possible. And in fact, and what limits the length of coal trains is that the couplers break. If you make, as the coal train, there's some maximum grade that the trains encounter on their way from the mine to the power plant, and the tension in the front couplers is the largest. It's basically pulling the component of the weight of the entire train up. And that's what has limited the length of coal trains to about a mile until about a decade ago, at which point they instituted something called remote power, in which they have remotely controlled engines, either at the end or in the middle or both, which push as well as pull and reduce the tension. And they can get up to trains 2 miles long. So here's a simple problem. I've got a mass and a spring, right? And I incline this thing that the mass is on, and there's no friction. And the question is, what's the, for a given, if I tell you that this spring is stretched in amount x, how much has, what is the angle theta? And you can work that out. I believe it's this one, right? But anyways, you can work out what the angle theta is. And so then here's another problem. So the point here is that, okay, so we have a simple way of measuring orientation then. If we can measure the stretch of the spring, we can measure the orientation of that incline. Okay, here's another one. I've got a mass on a spring, connected to a spring. And now I accelerate. I measure the stretch x of the spring. And what is the acceleration? And the point is, again, now I have a simple accelerometer. By measuring the stretch of the spring, I can determine the acceleration. So where does this crop up? Well, it turns out all of us have at least two or three of what are called otolith organs in each ear. And we use them to measure orientation and acceleration. Semicircular canals do angular acceleration. These do linear acceleration. And what are they? They're basically a chunk of limestone, calcium carbonate, on a spring, a flexible pedestal. And so when you accelerate forward, this deflects backwards. And, you know, if you look, you know, if I am bent backwards this way, you can see that there's a lot of tension on this side of me. And there are stretch-sensitive ion channels, so ions flow in and trigger neural impulses on that side, right? And similarly, if I bend this way, right, there's tension on the other side. And so that's the way you actually sense acceleration. And same thing for inclination. You tilt, right? So mass on a spring, that's how we all measure. We measure displacements of masses on springs to determine orientation and acceleration. Okay, here's one where you get to play. So which of the following curves best describes the force versus displacement for an earlobe? Okay, so this is, you get to play here. Take your hands out, grab your earlobe, and pull. Pull. And just feel with your hands how much it stretches as a function of how hard you're pulling. And then go ahead and vote. Okay, good. Very fast. All right, so most of you are picking number three, which is great. Number three is, in fact, the correct answer. Because, you know, when you first start pulling it, it hardly gives you any resistance at all. But, you know, after a while, once you get it stretched a certain amount, it really doesn't want to go much further, right? So it's actually number three. So then I have a little demonstration. You know, we have the force probe setups that you get from Vernier or Pasco. And I get an artery from some animal from the vet school. And I clamp it in the same force setup they use in lab, and I pull on it. And what I show them is that arteries are very elastic, and their elasticity has the same functional form, the same general shape. So then I ask them, well, you know, big deal. Why do you care? Why should you care what the force stretch curve of your arteries looks like? Okay. Well, in the lab, they had pulled on rubber bands, so latex rubber has this force stretch curve. So let's suppose that nature used the same polymer to make your arteries that it did to make rubber. So your heart starts to pump. What happens? You think that would be good for you? What do you call that? It's called an aneurysm, right? Not good for you, right? And so it turns out that this concave upward is important for the elastic stability, right? If you've got this form, you're prone to this kind of instability, right? So it's a way of showing how materials properties matter. So here's another example. Why do tennis nets sag, right? So if you go to your local tennis court, it sags. There's a sag in the middle. And even if you go to the U.S. Open, where presumably money is not an issue, or the Doha Open, which I guess was just last, no, that was golf. Even at the U.S. Open, the net sags in the middle. So why is that? Okay. Well, so we can consider this simple model where, you know, the mass here represents the mass of the net, and we hang it from two strings. And the question is, what's the relationship between the tension in those ropes and the mass? And you can convince yourself, I believe, that it's mg over 2 sine theta. Basically, the y components of the tension must equal the weight down. And so then what happens is theta goes to 0. Well, as theta goes to 0, it turns out that the tension must go to infinity. So if you were to try to make your net horizontal across, the tension would get so big that you'd either snap the cable or break the posts, right? And this has all kinds of other applications. It's one of the reasons why, you know, you think you got a big power line, these huge metal contraptions holding them up, and yet you get a couple inches of ice on that line, and the whole thing comes crashing down. What's the weight of that ice? It's not that much. But the increase in tension and the torque created by that increase in tension is huge. If you think about plucking guitar strings, think about trying to stretch a guitar string. You could try pulling along the length of it, and it's impossible. You can't do it. But if you pull sideways with your finger, you can easily stretch it a lot. The other thing you can use this for is getting your car out of a ditch. So I need a couple of volunteers, you and you. Please, you're volunteers. Okay? Okay? So first of all, we're going to have a tug of war. I want you two to go down there. Okay? Just grab, no, you don't have to be so far away. Just grab that. Okay, you're against, you're, really, it's you two against me. Okay? Should we go? Okay, wait, no, wait, I didn't mean. All right, ready, set, go! Okay, you win. Okay, let's try a different experiment. Okay, you go to the other end. Okay? Now, I want you to pull that rope really tight. Really tight. Really tight, and hold it really close to you. Now, all you have to do is stand there. Okay? I keep both feet on the ground. All you have to do is stand there. Okay? Pull it really tight as you can. Right? Okay? I can easily pull them off if I pull sideways. So, okay, now, you're my car. Okay? You are a tree.
Okay?
Trees don't have hands. Please, keep them down. Okay? So, come a little closer. Okay? So what I do is I tie one end of the rope to my car. I find myself a good tree, and I loop the rope around the tree. Okay? And oops, sorry. Okay, let's keep it up here. And then what do? I get it taut. I pull sideways while pulling the rope. See, you got too much friction here. You need to wear better clothing for this demo. Okay. So there. I pull it taut, and then I pull sideways. I can get pull a force that's equal to the component of the weight, pull it taut, and you can pull your car out of a ditch this way. Right? Really works. If you don't believe me, try it. But I don't want to hear about the result. Okay. Okay, well, let's give our assistants a little hand here. Let's see. Do I have couple more minutes? Can I go through one more series of... what's that? How much? Okay. So, here's one. So we talk about air drag, right, which is important. So how does the drag force exerted on a cyclist moving at 55 kilometers an hour compare with the force exerted on a cyclist moving at 27 kilometers an hour? Okay. So what's the formula for turbulent drag? It goes like V squared. So in fact, if you double the speed, you quadruple the drag force. So, you know, I do about 27 kilometers an hour when I cycle. Professional cyclists do 55, so it's only a factor of 2, but that's actually a factor of 4 in the force they're producing, and a factor of 8, it turns out, in the output power. Okay? So it turns out these are the world speed records, if you go to the Guinness Book of World Records, for these are the world speed records for 200 meters from a flying start, and for continuous cycling. So the question we can ask, so it's not very fast, 45 miles an hour is the best. The question is, how fast could you go if you just had to overcome the rolling resistance and frictional resistances in the gears of the bicycle? How fast could you go? Any guess? Well, here's the experiment that was done. It's at the Bonneville Salt Flats in Utah. So this is a race car that has this airfoil behind it. And, you know, one of the key ideas we stress in turbulent drag is that as an object moves through the air in the turbulent drag regime, there is a pocket of air behind it that is moving at approximately the speed of the object. And, in fact, the kinetic energy of that is something like one-half the density of air times V squared, and that's fundamentally why it goes like V squared. Okay? So that airfoil is creating a pocket of air that's moving at the speed of the car, and therefore, if the cyclist keeps moving at the speed of the car, all right? So that's how fast you can go, 167 miles an hour, the current world record. It was set by a Dutchman, Fred Rompelberg, when he was 50 years old. So there's hope for, well, okay. So many people ask, well, you know, he must have been cheating because, look, you know, there's this strap here, right? So there's a strap connected to the bike, you know. But no, he wasn't actually cheating. He wasn't towed up to the speed. I mean, think about it, you know. You're over the hill, you know. You're on the downward side of that hill there, you know, and, you know, life's looking bleak. But you've just set the world land speed record on a bicycle. What do you want to do? You want to go, yes, right? But the moment you stop pedaling, you slip back out of that airfoil, and then bam, you're hit by a Category 5 hurricane. Right? So that's what that strap's for. Well, it turns out the animal kingdom figured out this idea that you know, you can take advantage of moving air created by other objects to go faster and farther. And this is why birds fly in formation during migration. It turns out as they flap their wings, they create upwash of air. And if you fly in a formation, it turns out that the neighboring birds can take advantage of that moving air, and they can save about 40% of the energy. Similarly, this is why fish school. As the fish move through the water, they create vortices and moving water, and by swimming in formation, they can swim much farther than individual fish can swim. Well, I should probably stop at this point. I was going to tell you, this is actually one of my favorite examples, which is how do you throw a ball at 50 meters per second using molecules that move at microns per second? But I'll leave that as a homework problem. And just go to my summary, which is that physics is interesting and powerful, but it's also hard. And so we need to pay attention to the emotional needs of students. We need to show them why physics is relevant to what they care about. Oh, I forgot to change that. Which fundamentally is themselves, but, you know, and their futures. Why is it relevant? And then teach in a way that helps develop confidence and promotes future inquiry. Sorry about that. So with that, I'd like to stop and take any questions you may have. So the first time I taught this was in 99. And there was 180 students in the class. And as I said, there's a competing class that's an algebra-based auditorial course, which historically had twice the enrollment that our class had. The first time I taught it, my evaluations, I was so psyched about what I was doing. I got the evaluations. 3.0. Hateful comments, all, you know, just, it was just like before. It made no difference, right? But then, at the beginning of the semester, before the semester started the last term, I got this panicked phone call from our department secretary saying that all the sections are full. So enrollment jumped from 180 to 320, right? So, okay, that was a sign I'd done something. So then I went through, and it felt great, right? Get my evaluations back. Exactly the same. I couldn't believe it. I thought, oh, it must be, you know how students always say stupid test? Not stupid me, stupid test. That's a common thing. You know, it was a bad test. Well, that was my response. So I wrote up my own evaluation form, and I had the instructor in the next course in the sequence give it to them because I thought there was some biases in the way the form was written. Didn't change the result at all. So that at that point, I had only introduced the applications. Then I was on sabbatical for, I took two falls off, came back, I had this idea about the emotional stuff. So right now we're up, the course is saturated with students, and I get 4.0 and essentially no negative comments. And so it really works. But one of the things, there's a lot of stuff, talk to Eric Missouri, you talk to the people from Illinois, everyone has their monomaniacal approach. If you just introduce peer instruction, it will solve all your problems. If you just do, use our PowerPoint slides, interactive examples, it will solve all your problems. No. Teaching is an incredibly complex endeavor. And there are many, many things that you have to work on, and it takes a long time to get them all lined up and working well. And, it takes consistent effort. And this is where the polling comes in. You can consistently poll your students, and if you take seriously what they say, you can gradually mold what you're doing without changing your core content or pedagogy or your educational objectives. Mold what you're doing to get them to be involved and invested in the course. I think that would help a lot, but if you read the written evaluations, what they say is, Thorne is a very caring professor, and I love all the applications. And they don't comment anything about the fabulous labs that the course has. They don't comment about anything else, basically. Those are the only two things they really comment on. That's why, there's all this, if you talk to physics education research people, they're arguing about the best way to, teach, Ampere's law or something. You know, there's and it's kind of like, what's the old? Why are academic arguments so vicious? Because the stakes are so low, exactly. And somehow, this is what I feel that has gotten into. I think they lose sight of what the big educational picture is. There's a big component of psychology in here. You know, just trying to understand your clientele. I mean, I think a more productive approach is to think of this as a business and your students as customers, and you're doing market research, you know, to get them to, you know, what do you have? You have to understand your customers, right? But I think, they're paying for a service, which is to become competent at this stuff, right? And I think that's a better model. I think it's important to worry about the pedagogy, but I also think there are these higher level things, these first order effects that people typically completely ignore in their teaching, right? I think these improvements that the PER people focus on are second order effects. Important, but you got to deal with other things first. Sorry. That's an excellent question, and so far I have studiously avoided any attempt. Actually, it's just because I hadn't had the resources, but this fall, so we got this grant for this Physics Teacher Education Coalition grant. I just got it funded. And one of the first things I want to do is hire some people to actually implement the force concept inventory and some other standardized tests to measure our learning gains. But, I'm a firm believer in, metrics, evaluation, and that sort of thing. On the other hand, these things all have problems because I could easily teach to the FCI, right? And you can see I'm trying to do a lot of different things here in this course. I'm trying to educate them very broadly. And will an instrument like the FCI measure all of the different learning gains? So then you want to use other, I need other instruments to measure, there's one that's called another tool that it's called CLASS, Colorado Learning Attitudes. It's something that evaluates the students' attitudes toward learning. But if you look at that, there's nothing in there about that really deals with the kinds of things I'm trying to address. So I think actually there's really good education research problems in designing proper surveys so we know what our students are really thinking and what they're really learning. I think that's a really important area for future work. So, as far as I'm concerned, no. I think they're all identical. So what I do is I post my lecture notes online. So I handwrite them, but then I type them up, and I add extra comments on subtle details and things that I don't cover or that I screw up in lecture. And it all gets posted online. And most students find that the lecture notes, combined with all the problems I give them, all these in-lecture multiple choice questions and all the assigned problems and the homework and lab questions, that combination gets them, they don't have to spend that much time looking at the textbook. They can master the material. What I emphasize is physics is fundamentally about problem solving, right? And the gold standard against which to measure whether you're achieving in this course is, can you solve problems you haven't seen before on your own? I don't care if you've got a formula memorized. That won't help you, right? You have to be able to solve problems you haven't seen before on your own. I say that over and over and over again in lecture and in messages, and they buy into it. And then you give them supportive messages that, it's okay if you don't get them immediately, right? But once they get the idea that this is different than biology, that memorization won't get them anywhere, and it's this problem solving, that this is what you'd get paid the big bucks for in the real world. It's not being able to regurgitate things that you could get a computer to regurgitate. It's to be able to solve problems that people haven't solved before, whether they're physics problems or biology problems or, problems in your marriage, wherever, right? These are what people get paid for, is problem-solving skills, and that's the most important thing that I, in terms of a transferable skill.
When do they learn physics?
Yes,
because you talk about problem solving, but you get a hotspot of a collection of things where they don't necessarily need the physics.
Oh, no, that's not a problem.
The, you know, the structure, the the paradigm of physics, you know, thought structure. They don't get it.
They.
This is my work.
Yeah. Okay. So that's an interesting question, and probably quite a complicated one to answer. You know, my goal is my focus is on training people who can solve problems, and who are not afraid to tackle problems in a broad spectrum of areas. Whether they get the theology of physics, you know, I think they'll get the theology of science elsewhere. You know, if they don't already have it, but they're getting it in different ways, because I talk about ongoing experiments in some of the applications, you know, state-of-the-art experiments like LIGO. I talk about all kinds of things. I have a little session where I talk about intelligent design and you know, what are the issues when one thinks about intelligent design. So I, you know, you try to engage the students broadly, but I don't have any particular agenda to try to convey to them, you know, what's his name, you know, some Thomas Kuhn's ideas or something like that. That's not my job. I have a more pragmatic view of what I'm trying to get across to them.
I would just comment about this question of the course concept in regard to the civic education research as kind of a session. I think if you can teach the course and have the same outcome, but they hate it less,
yes.
That's still success.
Yes, and in fact, well, so we did do FCI and that sort of thing in that first revision I talked about in the mid-90s. And our learning gains were fine. They were as good as anyone else's. But they still hated the course, right? So now I'm interested to see. I think your point is very well taken. But I'd like to think that, you know, I think the idea of having proper metrics is a really important one. This is the whole problem with education, right, is having proper metrics. And we need to think hard about those metrics and use more than one when we're evaluating things.
And the other question was, you talked about fluids and thermal stuff in that course, which is something we don't do.
Yeah.
Is that chosen because of you want to make it relevant to biological or everyday things, or is that just something that's been handed to you?
It was in there, but I expanded it because it's clear it's, What I've downplayed, so we talk about torque and static equilibrium, but we don't talk about rotations the way they do in the engineering sequence. And we do thermo, we talk about, you know, the laws of thermodynamics. I don't talk about entropy. I don't talk about, heat engines only to the extent that I give the Carnot formula, right? I talk about, you know, I don't go through the PV diagrams and all that stuff, because I don't think it's relevant. And fluid mechanics is, I mean, look, every practicing scientist should know Stokes' law, right? Every practicing scientist should know Stokes' law. So that's... Okay, let's pull... Oh, the pull, clicker zero. Go ahead, please. I got no chili peppers. That's the only thing I'm pissed about. No chili peppers.
Actually, on that subject, they say that Kevin Moore, the course rating goes up with the attractiveness of the professor, so I was going to ask if you could comment on the relevance between...
Well, I'm proof. I'm proof that that's, plastic surgery is in my future, I guess. Okay. Makeup.
So how relevant is it whether they, like, is there, do we know that there's a correlation between how they like the course and how well they're, like, so what if they hate the course? Maybe they, still know those skills.
Well, that's actually true. I mean, I think this goes to Stephen's comment that, in fact, you know, they're still learning the material, even if they hate it. But, you know, what I find is just, it's so much less painful to get them to do the work if they're actually enjoying it. It's just amazing the difference it makes. You know, it's like there's this, the atmosphere in the classroom and in the sections is just so different, you know. And that just makes it, you know, they know that they're doing something that's hard, but it's going to be important, and you know, they're going to put up with it. right? And I think it's a really great feeling to have that feeling, you know. And look, I'm sensitive, you know. I'm narcissistic. I don't like to be hated.
Okay, good point too. Yeah, and this is just one comment. If you still have a clicker, I think Stephen grabbed them all. But if you still have a clicker, please bring it up to the front. Please.
And I'm happy to answer any other questions if anyone would like to come up and chat.
Please join me in thanking Rob once more.